The last case of the morning is number 012821, Michael Dyke against O'Neill Steel Company. Mr. Myers.
Your Honor, may it please the court, my name is Chris Myers and I represent Michael Dyke. Michael Dyke has one eye. It was removed after an attempted mugging in 1989. He applied for and received a job at O'Neill Steel through a temporary agency, and I believe that was in November of 1998. He did an excellent job as a parts cleaner for O'Neill Steel, so well in fact that his supervisor and the plant superintendent asked him to submit an application for a full-time position of materials handler. He did so. The person to whom he handed his application was an executive secretary, and that exchange is basically what this whole case is about. He handed the application to Dee Harder, I believe her name was, and she looked at him and thought he looked odd, that he had a problem, and upon noticing his one eye, said, you're uninsurable. You can't work here. And indeed, within hours, he was fired.
If vision in both eyes was necessary for safety on the job, how can we consider him a qualified individual, even for a temporary position?
Because vision for the temporary job was, in fact, not a requirement. Furthermore, the district court found that the mere suggestion that a regulation or an internal guideline at a company that would require two eyes to work almost raises the inference that in fact they perceived him as being unable to see and therefore perceived him as being unable to work.
Is it clear that vision is not a requirement for the temporary job?
Well, Your Honor, as a matter of experience it is. My client did an excellent job for the sum.
He didn't cause an accident the time he was there.
No, he did not.
But that doesn't really preclude the company from having a uniform policy that for this particular kind of work, the person with one eye is impaired and is an unacceptable risk. Is there any evidence that they would not have this policy for a temporary employee, even though they did have this policy for their regular employees?
Yes, the evidence showed that there was no such policy for temporary employees. How did it show that? Well, my understanding, my recollection of all the evidence in the case, because we asked for all the regulations and guidelines, there was no such guideline given for a temporary job. Now,
anything to the contrary?
There is something to the contrary, and that is, there was a, I believe, an affidavit from Mr. Smith indicating that at the end of, I believe it was 30 days, normally a temporary employee would have to take either visual acuity tests or agility tests.
Could he have ever sent past the acuity test?
I don't know. In fact, he did not take the test. And so, of course, he did not pass it. There is expert testimony submitted by the defendant that, in fact, he could not have passed. And so this case essentially only deals with the 2 weeks of remaining work that the plaintiff would have enjoyed.
That was my next question. Is that all you're appealing at this point?
That is all that we are appealing, is that regarded as discrimination that happened to Mr. Dyke, resulting in his termination, and the 2 weeks of remaining employment that he would have enjoyed had that discrimination not occurred.
Are you saying that vision in both eyes cannot be a valid safety requirement of a job because he was able to work there for 2 weeks without an accident?
I'm not saying that it cannot be, ever. I'm saying that the facts of this case are such that it was not a regulation, and in fact it was not something that was employed or practiced upon temporary employees at O'Neill Steel. My client in fact worked there for 2+ weeks without having to take any kind of visual acuity test, and again he did a fine job. The district court ruled in favor of the defendant on summary judgment, even though the court did find that there were facts that could cause a reasonable fact finder to infer that regarded as discrimination occurred also found that an adverse employment action, that there was evidence of that, but also ruled that my client was not qualified and thus applied the doctrine of judicial estoppel. That's what we're appealing in this case. Our position is that in a case such as this, where an employer very clearly has a visceral reaction to someone who has a disfigurement, okay, or one eye, as in this case, and basically makes the determination right then and there that you are fired, and in fact carries through with that termination, that judicial estoppel should not be rigidly applied. Why? Because the core facts underlying the claim of regarded as discrimination have nothing to do with the representations that my client made to Social Security Disability Administration. At the time that the discrimination occurred, my client was doing an excellent job. And for all the defendant knew, strike that, what the defendant knew was that the defendant had no knowledge about his prior representations to Social Security Disability. I understand that the defendant makes the point in their brief that that shouldn't matter. But I think that in this type of case, in this type of regarded as case, it should matter. Why? Because the regarded as case that we're dealing with here was completed, that is, the discrimination was a done deal at the time my client was asked to leave his employment. If we don't recognize the discrimination on the part of the defendant in this case, it seems to me that we are not recognizing, and in fact we are thwarting, the goals and purposes of the Americans with Disabilities Act. I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. We'll hear now from Mr. Proctor.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is David Proctor. I represent O'Neill Steel in this matter. And the first point I'd like to make is that there are three alternative reasons that this court can affirm this judgment.
Okay, well, only one was used by the district court, am I right?
Your Honor, I think actually two were used by the district court. One was that the plaintiff was not qualified for the position based on the failure to be able to pass the vision test. Second was the estoppel issue. I take great disagreement with my worthy counsel about the record as to the application of the vision test to the temporary position. In fact, the record shows undisputedly that the temporary employees were required to take a vision test at 30 days. The reason that for that delay is many temporary employees only come in for a day or two, and it would be somewhat cost prohibitive to apply a test to all those persons. But, yes, Your Honor.
Please, go ahead.
But Mr. Smith's affidavit makes clear that if there are circumstances in which the company discovers that someone cannot meet their valid qualification standards, such as, and he gave the example in the affidavit, an employee or temporary employee self-identifying a disability that would make them or cause them not to be able to establish the qualification standards, including the vision test, then the temporary employee would be released because they are not qualified. So that's the first ground that this court can affirm the judgment. The second, and the district court, I think, was the only place the district court got off track a little bit was on the regarded as evidence. I'll come back to that. And third, that on the estoppel claim, the reason we say that it shouldn't matter when we discovered this is in the reality of litigation. The defendant never knows about a Social Security, or at least rarely knows about a Social Security misrepresentation at the time of the employment decision. Usually these things are discovered in litigation, and I think if we look at the cases from Cleveland to Feldman to their progeny, we'll see that often these are discovered during subsequent situations. The policy here is not to thwart the ADA. The policy here is that you can't step into one forum and say X is true in order to achieve financial gain, and then step into a second forum, say that X is not true to achieve financial gain, unless you can reconcile those two positions to the satisfaction of the court sitting as the guardian of that issue. In this case, The only evidence on the estoppel claim is that Mr. Dyke says, as far, in the lower court anyway, was that I was going to continue trying, I wasn't giving up, and the court correctly concluded, and it's really an easy question for us. The court concluded that that simply is not sufficient. In fact, that falls far short of the many explanations that have been rejected by this court, district courts in this circuit, and other courts around the country. The one thing I do take issue with in the trial court, and I might be stepping off the road a second, is that the plaintiff put forth great evidence from his perspective of how Dee Harder regarded him. But Dee Harder is not O'Neill Steele, and I want to apologize to the court because looking back at my brief, I perhaps did not make this point as clear as I should have. But it's undisputed in this record that Dee Harder is not O'Neill Steele. In fact, she's not a decision maker. That is conceded by the plaintiff at page 5 of the appellant's brief, where he says, after Dyke left Harder's office, she called the Corporate Human Resource Office. O'Neill decided that Dyke could not be a temp, and the corporate decision makers instructed Ms. Harder to call Blue Jean Jobs and have Dyke released. So the first point is, it is irrelevant what Harder regarded him as. It is relevant what O'Neill regarded him as being, whether he was substantially limited.
Now, did O'Neill consider him unable to perform a particular job or just unable to be employed, period?
O'Neill, I think, Your Honor, the only inference we can draw from this, contrary to what the district court said in that one portion of its opinion, is that O'Neill regarded him as having monocular vision and therefore unable, as a matter of fact and logic, to pass its vision acuity standards, which are in the qualification standards that the plaintiff in this case has conceded are non-discriminatory, has not challenged on appeal, and the court has concluded were both job-related and consistent with business necessity, the two standards we have to meet here for those qualification standards.
Now, the press has reported some new decision by the Supreme Court affecting this. I haven't had a chance to
read it. I have read it, Your Honor.
On this case?
Yes, sir. I'm new to the court. This is my first appearance, so I didn't know if Rule 34 permitted me to bring up a case that hasn't been cited, but I think it is appropriate to discuss it. That case was limited to the prong A of the definition about whether someone is substantially limited in a major life activity, and the issue in the Toyota case was whether or not they were limited, substantially limited, in the area of manual tasks. That was a carpal tunnel syndrome case and some other maladies that the plaintiff had. The reason that case does not help the plaintiff is A, the court actually narrowed the standard of what we view as substantially limited now. Second, this is not a substantially limited case. This plaintiff conceded that issue in his brief, quite properly so, I believe. And third, if anything, what it does is it helps my argument on the regarded as claim, because in order to regard someone as being disabled, you don't have to, it's not a matter of regarding them as having an impairment. The two prongs require regarding them as having an impairment when they don't have one and believing it's substantially limited, or correctly perceiving them as having an impairment but misperceiving that that impairment substantially limits them in a major life activity. So I think Toyota actually supports my position on that issue. I think that what we have to look at in order to determine what O'Neill perceived is the undisputed testimony of what occurred between Harder, the secretary, and her communications with O'Neill decision makers. Harder testified without dispute that she contacted a woman in the Corporate Human Resources Department named Christy Nolan. Christy Nolan was posed the question by Harder, can someone with one eye get employment here at O'Neill Steel? Now, keep in mind, and this is important, I think, in this context, all these discussions at this point, as I read the record, deal with the question of whether Dyke can apply for a full-time position. There's no evidence that Harder called and asked, do we have to go ahead and terminate him now from the temporary position? She was calling to ask, should I accept an application from someone who has one eye? Nolan's response in the Corporate Human Resources Department in Birmingham was, I don't think so, but I have to check. I'll get back with you. The record shows that within a half hour to an hour, no one contacted Harder back. No one said, first, no, he would not be able to pass our vision test. So that's what O'Neill perceived. And second, because he cannot meet that standard, we have to release him as a temporary employee. Now, it's not just the Smith affidavit that makes clear that the qualification standard does and should apply to a temporary position. Dr. Kleinstein's report makes quite clear that this is not a small, insignificant matter. Indeed, his report shows that even a temporary employee, like Dyke, who worked at O'Neill in a temporary position as a parts cleaner, nevertheless had to navigate from the punch-in area, the break area, through the warehouse where there's protruding steel, hoists, cranes holding massive pieces of metal, and therefore that in and of itself created substantial, significant dangers to anybody who made that trip. And therefore, it is logical, factual, and legal that this qualification standard applies to temporary and full-time employees. There's no dispute about that in the record. Unless the court has any other questions, I'm prepared to stand on my brief and argument thus far today. And it's been an honor to appear before you.
Thank you, Mr. Proctor. Mr. Myers?
I'll take these matters in the orders that were presented by defense counsel. First, with respect to the policies at issue in this case, it seems like on the one hand, we have a policy whereby a plaintiff should not be allowed to make representations and get money, and then on the other hand, go to work doing the very thing that he represented that he couldn't do before the administrative body. But that policy really isn't in play here, because the discrimination that was practiced against Michael Dyke was regarded as discrimination. It occurred instantaneously out of a visceral reaction by an executive secretary. We're not suing the Harder. And I didn't know this was going to be an issue in the case at all. It hasn't been up to this point. Dee Harder made a phone call. She carried through with whatever her perceptions were. She called corporate and secured their approval to terminate my client's employment, and that's exactly what happened. So O'Neill is on the hook. The other policy at play is that defendants ought not get a free bite at discrimination, even if a plaintiff has made prior representations to the Social Security Administration, which would otherwise defeat his claim in the actual impairment context. There's a way to satisfy these policies, and I talked about it, I believe, on page 15 of my reply brief, and that is to do what the Supreme Court did in McKinnon in the after-acquired evidence case. It took the position that, yes, even though this after-acquired evidence may reveal facts which would have caused the employer not to hire the employee at all in the first place, that doesn't mean that the plaintiff's claim is totally defeated. What you can do is cut off the plaintiff's damages instead of just ruin the cause of action totally. I read the Kelly v. Toyota case as well. It specifically didn't deal with regarded as discrimination at all, and it did not deal with judicial estoppel, so I think it has very little value here. Unless there are any further questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Myers.
Thank you.
Indeed, our thanks to both Mr. Myers and Mr. Proctor for their fine presentations here today. The case will be taken under advisement. We have finished the call of the day, and therefore the court will rise until the next session scheduled for this afternoon.